Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And Don't Cry For Me, 21st Century Park.
Very good.
How about that?
Very good. It's better than Argentina.
So onions can bring some pretty serious tears to my eyes sometimes if they're really hot. But we're going to talk about onions today and meet the new director of parks for the park system that's being developed along Floyd's Fork by 21st Century Parks. Scott Martin, fabulous guy.
Yeah, very enthusiastic guy. He's here from Virginia, and he's the right guy for the right job here. And I have no objectivity about this project
at all.
I'll confess this up front, because part of my retirement gig is I'm a historian for this project. I get to go along Floyd's Fork and talk to the people that live there and
wonderful.
Write their stories from Fisherville to Seatonville to Bardstown. I just love it. And Scott just fits the bill. Directing the new project, the new parks, he can explain exactly what's going to happen all the way from Shelbyville Road to Bardstown Road, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
22 miles of river and almost 4,000 acres of land.
It's just really kind of an exciting, a unique sort of
to the country.
Plan. Yeah, it really is. So we'll find out more details from Scott, and we are delighted to have him in Louisville.
Oh, yeah.
He seems to be sharp as a tack, and that's always good to have people like that running your parks.
Oh, yeah.
All right, very forward-thinking folks here. Bob, the onion thing. Do you plant onions?
I actually started again last year.
Okay, because I've gotten to be very good at it, in fact. And Dr. Bill Randall is a good instructor in terms of, you know, from start to finish, planting your slips, choosing the right varieties, what makes onions hot or not so hot, what makes them store longer. He's going to teach us all of that. So I'll be able to perfect my onion growing skills yet again another year. I'm getting ready to plant them in the garden. Now is the time to get your onion slips in. So grab your notebook, folks, if you're interested in growing onions.
And watch the rivulets of tears run down
That's
your cheeks.
That's right. Or not.
Yeah.
He'll help us pick out varieties that won't make us cry. How
exactly,
about that?
Exactly, yeah.
All right. There are times for onions that are sweet, and there are times for onions that will bring tears to your eyes.
Okay.
I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
All right, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Speaking of new things, we talked about heirloom seeds a while back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got the catalog, and I'm planting some heirloom annual seeds I'd never seen or heard of.
Good.
This is going to be fun.
Okay.
I, of course, forgot the...
So flowers.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Annuals. Well, and some veggies, too, I think.
Okay, good.
I forgot the names, of course, but there's some old Rudbeckia I'm going to plant, and there's some really funky sunflowers I'm looking forward to plant.
Good.
Some short ones and tall ones. So I'll report back on those and how my heirloom seeds are doing. But I'm part of history now.
Heirloom stuff always seems to do better for me somehow.
We'll find out.
It's just like they're tougher cookies.
Well, I'm getting more heirloomy myself by the minute.
I know. So you need to support yourself.
Yeah, more ways than one, kiddo.
How
about you? What's up with the Wishy Estate?
Well, I do want to say that I'm kind of proud of myself this year.
Well, I'm proud of you every day.
I managed to start our Skag mower.
Get out of here. All by yourself?
I can start the mower. But usually, the first time I try to get it started in the season, I mean, don't you have this problem?
Absolutely.
You can't get it started.
I have a neighbor who comes over.
See, and I've been lucky because Mike Cottrell up at Cottrell's in Simpsonville has tutored me over the last several years. And really, he's the reason that I have acquired a basic knowledge. It's like, you know, I don't know how to do anything beyond check the oil, the spark plug, the carburetor stuff, the little thingy-mabob, whatever it's called.
Exactly.
The air filter and all that. And, you know, the spark plug, et cetera, et cetera. And I now know how to, like, I used to be afraid of the whole battery charger thing.
Oh, yeah.
It just scares, you know, like I'm afraid something bad's going to happen, right? So I just calmly check all of the stuff, the troubleshooting that Mike taught me about. The battery clearly was, you know, sluggish.
Yep.
I didn't get any help from anybody. I followed my notes on my little thing with my battery charger.
Yeah.
I charged the battery, did some weeding, came back when it was full.
Listen to this. Wow.
Turned the key and
it started
up. I pretty much was surprised because usually it doesn't, and then I'm frustrated for a week and, you know.
Yeah.
So
I'm going to bring in the Skag Mower merit badge for you next week. We'll put it on the wall here.
But it's two things. It's like you need a little knowledge, right?
Yep.
And you need some time to build up a level of confidence to
right.
execute.
Yeah.
And I think this is the first year that I had enough of a level of confidence that I can take care of this, stay calm. And I did.
It's funny because I'm working and looking helpless.
Yeah. I was just somebody else just the could opposite, do it. Yeah.
My neighbors think I'm totally helpless, and I don't want to change their minds in any way, shape,
true.
Or form.
That's true. If you've got a neighbor that's willing to come over and get it started for you, yeah.
Well, we give them some money.
More power to you. Yeah. All right. So good. It's a good start to the season if Janine can start her mower all by herself for the first time. And guess what? The grass doesn't even need to be mowed yet. I was just getting a start.
It's waiting.
Yeah. All right, Bob, the season has begun for sure, and we're starting to get more calendar events in. There's a joint celebration of Kentucky Arbor Day to give away a bunch of trees. It's in Deer Park, Upper Highlands, and the Highland Douglas Neighborhood Associations. They're working together. On April 3rd, they're going to give away more than 1,500 trees from the Kentucky Division of Forestry to anyone who signs the United Nations Environmental Program's pledge to plant and nurse the trees to adulthood.
You get to live to be 100 years old then, too.
That's right.
That's good.
So you definitely want, if you're looking for some good trees to add to your landscape, and after all the storms we've had over the last couple of years, a lot of people probably are, but you might want to check that out. In Deer Park, a Highlands celebration of Kentucky Arbor Day to give away trees, April 3rd.
And another personal note, an absolute miracle of capitalism, our Hidden Hill Nursery opens for the 10th season.
Ah, I got my mower started and Hidden Hill's open.
That's right. April 3rd and 4th.
Okay, great.
The 4th's the big day, of course. We're going to have kite flying and a kite contest, a special blacksmith demonstration. And we have all sorts of great new plants and trees and shrubs, and we just love to see our old friends because most of our customers are really friends by now. It's just kind of fun to have. So
it is nice.
See HiddenHillNursery.com for more details and a map to Utica, Indiana.
All right. Sounds good. The season has begun.
You betcha.
Also, another thing that sort of marks our gardening season are all of the community garden tours, Bob. And you've heard us talk about the garden tour passport.
Yep.
Well, it's now available for, you know, pre-purchase. And if you buy the passport, you get tours at Crescent Hill Garden Club tour, which is June 5th, Audubon Park Garden Tour, which is June 26th, and then the Old Louisville Hidden Treasures Garden Tour, which is July 10th and 11th. But you save like $8 if you buy the passport and you get to go to all three. So you can check out our website at wfpl.org for details on where you can find that passport. All right.
And speaking of hidden treasures, the Floyd's Fork Park Project is a hidden treasure that's in full bloom over the next couple of years.
That's
we have the first parks director, Scott Martin, born in Virginia. He's worked creating and preserving parkland in Idaho, and more lately in Franklin County in south central Virginia, where he helped lead a development of a 50-mile public blueway system, which means along water. Scott, welcome to Homegrown.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Now let's talk a little more about your background. You know, you grew up in Virginia, went off to Utah, and came back to Virginia. But what led you into the parks business?
Actually, I hate to correct you, but I have to. Idaho, for my fine alma mater, Boise State. I couldn't let that one pass. I tell you, I'm probably like a lot of folks in the park business, where parks or woods or open space played a pretty formative part of our past and our childhood, and we figured out this is the coolest thing in the world. Let's see if we can figure out a way to make a living doing it. Mm-hmm. And when you look at a project like the Forks from far away, when I looked at it from 300 or 400 miles away, the size, the scope, the enormity, and quite frankly, the vision of the project is nothing short but amazing.
Mm-hmm. Are there other plans similar to this happening across the country, or is it unique in and of itself in terms of what's being done, but also just the resources that are available that allow us to move forward?
Yeah, great question. A lot of communities have a lot of great ideas and visions. There are probably about 5 or 6 projects of this scale across the country right now. I think the unique story about Louisville is that the funding to execute the vision is here.
Okay.
This is really going to happen. Dallas has a wonderful project, Trinity Park Project. There's one down in Orange County. There's Shelby Farms in Memphis, Fresh Kills in New York. You can list a few of them. But this one is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And the neat thing, I think, about this project is how authentic it is to the community it's serving, whereas the money that's been raised for it has come from Louisville. These aren't national foundations or national interests that have kicked in. These are Louisvillians, am I using the term right, that have really stepped up and seen the vision and got behind it.
So what is the scope of the project?
Well, aside from hiding Bob Hill for as many hours as we can out there chasing stories, The scope is about 3,800 to 4,000 acres of Floyd's Fork, which roughly speaking will run from Miles Park, which a lot of folks know up on Shelbyville Road right across from Valhalla Golf Course, mm-hmm. down to Bardstown Road. And if you follow Floyd's Fork through that, it's about 22 miles of the river. It snakes through right about 3,800, again, 4,000 acres of land. And then it's going to allow for the construction of some linear paths, some major parks within it that I'm sure we'll speak to. But probably most importantly is it's really going to define that eastern edge of Louisville. It's an edge-defining project. You know, great cities have great downtowns, and we talk a lot about what we can do on urban redevelopment. Well, this project is about that edge development, where you can define what the city is like and what it lives like, not only today, but frankly, 100 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's being done with the understanding that there will be people living near the park. This isn't going to be remote in a sense. It'll be like the Olmsted Park, so you're protecting this corridor down with sure to be development around it.
Absolutely, Bob. There's a lot of discussion about how do we deal with suburban sprawl? How do we deal with those things? Well, one thing you can do is you can get ahead of it and develop the infrastructure, and in our case, the green infrastructure that's needed to support populations. We think the most successful parks in the nation are the ones where the neighborhoods are turned towards the park. Cherokee Park here is an absolutely perfect mm-hmm. example of that, where houses front the park. The trick, though, is to do that, of course, you have to come with the park before the houses arrive.
Right.
And we're fortunate that some very farsighted leaders in this community and some great partners have stepped up, adopted that vision, and have executed it.
Well, Scott, let's talk a little bit about the three entities involved in this and how they work together to pull this project off.
Sure, Bob. I think first and foremost is our organization, the one I'm very privileged to work for, Dan Jones and the 21st Century Parks Board and Group. That is a nonprofit group that not only has been acquiring the land in the public's interest out at the fork, but also will be the operator, hence the reason I was hired to be operator of the park. The second key partner, of course, is the Future Fund Foundation. They are a land trust conservancy organization that's been an integral partner for acquiring the land and then placing it into park easement or trail easement on site as well. And finally is, of course, Metro Parks and the Metro Governance here in Jefferson County and Louisville. They have a number of parks that have been incorporated into the Floyd's Fork project, and they also are key supporters in terms of knowledge, infrastructure support, and political support to make this happen.
Well, yeah. Now, where do you personally begin on a project like this? You come from Virginia, you see this 22 miles of water and this 4,000 acres of park, and you say, oh my gosh, where do I begin?
Yeah, it the analogy to use out west is, you know, when you see the wolf and then you grab it by the ears and then you realize, oh my gosh, I've got the wolf by the ears now. what do I do now? The simplest way is the way that we are doing construction, and that is this is going to be a phased development. Phase one hopefully will begin this summer, which will be some improvements at Miles Park and then the Mayor's Playground, which will be going in the north side of the park. So we're going to be able to bite our way off very slowly in a very disciplined and strategic fashion so that we can take on ownership and operation within our budget that fits, but also, most importantly for our park visitors, with a level of service that exceeds that of which they've probably seen.
Mm-hmm. So we'll go through the different actual places that people can access this whole system, if it's in your neighborhood sort of thing. But how much has actually been accomplished? Do you know what I mean? What's tangibly there already that people can access?
Great point. Great question. There are a couple of things that are there that are being incorporated into our overall park. I think first we have to give a lot of credit to the folks at Metro Parks, because Miles Park, mm-hmm. Tyler Schooling, and Floyd's Fork Park, three existing public parks, are going to be incorporated as part mm-hmm. of the overall management plan and master plan for us. So you've got those facilities that are coming in. You say what's been done thus far. Well, 3,800 acres has been acquired through private transactions with private commitment to mm-hmm. get that done. That's kind of unique. There hasn't been condemnation. There hasn't been this really adversarial
yeah.
sort of deal. These are willing land negotiations that have been committed to. So the land, of course, is the first piece. Acquire it, then you can set it up. Mm-hmm. The second thing is there's been a master plan that's been adopted. Kind of unique deal. Yeah, a lot of folks are very familiar with conservation easements. I think we're all confident with what that means now. The land that's been placed in this park has been tied to a public recreational and public benefit easement, which means that the master plan that's been adopted, and folks can see that on our website, 21cparks.org, those visions are tied now to the land itself, which is a really unique deal. So 100 years from now, when we're all dead and gone, the land has to reflect the vision for public recreational purposes. Mm-hmm. And that is a staggeringly unique thing across the country right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do have to throw in, too, also that Mitch McConnell, love him or hate him, did kick in $38 million dreaded earmark for this thing, so it's not all just donations. There is some federal money involved in this thing.
Right, for construction. Thank you, Bob, for pointing that out, because our elected leaders love to hear that.
I know.
That infrastructure is absolutely vital, and that will pay for the construction of the Louisville Loop that will run through our park and also the Parkway roads. Mm-hmm. And without those dollars, it's doubtful those connections would happen.
Okay, yeah. So Scott, let's talk about some of the details. You talk about the loop and the roads and that sort of thing. So how many different locations, if you've got this great book that shows all these different areas, kind of sectioning off the whole thing in thirds. Mm-hmm. So can we start at the top, if you will, and go to the bottom and highlight some of the things that will be accessible?
Absolutely. And with the scale project this big, it really helps to break it into those smaller chunks, like you said. And for the mm-hmm. sake of this discussion, I'm going to speak in very broad generalities.
Sure.
Folks that want to see our particulars are welcome to get online and take a look at the plan. Starting with the north, with Miles Park down through the Egg Lawn and the Grand Allée, the northern portion of the park is going to be a pretty typical park in that it will be heavily landscaped within the developed park acreage. It will have large buffers around it at most locations to provide forest cover, habitat, and riparian conservation for our river corridor. And we really see it as being host to some of the best walks you can take in Louisville. So that, you know, the great walk that everyone enjoys at Seneca Park mm-hmm. or at Cherokee or Iroquois, that we bring that experience to that northern portion of the park. The northern portion will also have one of two neighborhood or community parks, and that is what we hope to begin construction this summer. Mayor Jerry Abramson was kind enough to provide a commitment to supply the funds that are needed for that community park. That community park will have a playground, a spray ground, and then you'll see a lodge. The Gaines Foundation mm-hmm. has kindly supported the development of a community center lodge right on the river that right. we know is going to be extraordinarily popular for weddings and meetings and events like that. And then you have the Egg Lawn, and that's captured, I think, a lot of folks' imagination. So when you come off 64, let's say you're going towards Frankfort, off to your right there, mm-hmm. right when you come by Floyd's Fork, you see a big turf area there. You see a big sod farm. That's going to be converted into a grand play area.
Fabulous.
And with a big walk, a big loop, and a big open play area where you can throw frisbees till your heart's content out there without hitting anyone.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think Miles Park, there is a canoe get-in place there now, for lack of a more specific term, that I used last spring. And
I think they're called launch.
Oh, that's what, canoe launch. Okay. I'm a wordsmith. The canoe get-in place in Miles Park. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, personally, I'm a paddler, so that's one of the things that really drew me to this project is the series of river access points that we have. And you just mentioned the great one, Bob, there at Miles Park, which is already built, part of Metro Parks program and the mayor's programs as well. We think part of our mission is getting folks to look at our rivers in possibly a different way than they have. You know, how many times do we all drive down the interstate and you hear expansion joints when you go over a river? You hear ka-thunk, ka-thunk. Mm-hmm. And that's how folks encounter rivers. We want to slow down that space. And we know we'll have done our job when you see cars that hit those expansion joints and a bunch of heads pop up to see what the river looks like. That we see as one of our key missions.
Are environmental issues a part of what you guys are going to be responsible for as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the first thing you can do to preserve and protect the environment, of course, is make sure you take care of what you own. Mm-hmm. So for our project and our operations, you're going to see a standard of riparian buffers, of forest planting, of invasive species management, of some of our wildlife management mm-hmm. that exceeds that of the standard that we're used to. Mm-hmm. We want to be a model for how cities deal with these waterways, because as a lot of folks know, Floyd's Fork, while, you know, it has its issues, it actually is a pretty doggone clean river considering its proximity to a top 50 urban area in the mm-hmm. United States. We want to do our part to inform that and preserve that. Now, of course, the challenges are, number one, we can't control what comes in above us. But what we can do is all the little streams and wetlands that come in through our park, we can do our job there to make sure the water quality is managed in a way that respects the environment and that creates great habitat for all the mussels and the smallmouth bass and the sauger that call Floyd's Fork home.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting too, Scott, when you were showing us the plan that in one of the parks where was a large meadow, the use plan for these areas is something a little bit different than I think most people are used to as well. And it reminds me of crop rotation, basically, to keep certain pieces of land healthy and sustainable, basically a sustainable sort of people use thing. So talk a little bit about how you guys plan to manage land use.
Yeah, we're firm believers in kid rotation, lack of a better term. You know, we've got a chance here because we're starting from scratch to learn from lessons that everyone else has learned after they built something. Mm-hmm. So one of the things you'll see us do is for our trails, the turf areas, which could be programmed, you're going to see us use adaptive management techniques where we partner with our users and say, look, this area is going to be this activity this summer. Next summer, it may be something different. Or this trail will be closed for these months while it recovers, and it'll be open in another couple months. Mm-hmm. In the interim, simply because of the scale of the geography, we're going to be able to provide additional space to take that use and move it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So just like you said, I think you used the perfect analogy, the crop rotation. You'll see us probably employ some activity rotation. And to get through that looking glass, though, is really it's going to be a partnership between us and our park visitors to see that that happens, where it's not just, you know, a top-down management decree, thou shalt not play here.
Right.
We want to work with our users. We want to engage them, educate them, and have them help us develop the management models for what activities actually take place over the next 50 to 100 years at the park.
Let's move downriver some now. We've kind of done the Fisherville area. Let's move down the Seatonville area. Well, the good news is more in that area, roughly, that you've just purchased some land that connected the north and the south parts of this park. So we're moving from Fisherville towards Seatonville, and tell us what's going on.
That connection is really critical, is providing the linkage between the whole park. So nothing is more frustrating than you're on a trail or the greenway, and you know, you're bebopping along, and you go 5 miles, and you hit a stop.
Yeah,
you know,
do not enter.
Yeah, do not enter. Stop, turn around, you know. Yeah. Thanks to the Future Fund, Metro Government, and the folks at 21st Century, that connection is now complete through Seatonville that allows the north and southern sections of the park to connect. Mm-hmm. And we start to see a little different use. We start to change our use as we move further south, where wildlife conservation, habitat restoration, those start to take increased focus at those locations. We'll be adding, and don't hold many of these new numbers as the new guy, something like 500 acres of new forest within the park's footprint over the next 10 to 15 years. In the southern part of the park, and then we're talking Seatonville Road south, Bob, to Bardstown right. Road, is right. Where you're going to see us look at wetland restoration. We're going to look at keeping active agriculture in the park. We think that the Louisville Loop should go through cornfields and soybean fields, and because that's part of our heritage. You know, we are a farming-based community. When you look at the history of why Louisville grew up, it was to get crops to market, mm-hmm. And we're still going to be part of that crop discussion. On the recreation side, this is where we really twist and start to hit the more outdoor events. You're going to see a lot of equestrian trail mileage, probably about 15 miles of equestrian trails down there. You'll probably see, you know, a significant amount of mountain bike trails, of hiking trails, possibly a family outdoor center, adventure center that'll have zip lines, perhaps a climbing wall. Those sort of creative outdoor next generation activities that are growing in popularity right now, mm-hmm. and that there's not a lot of opportunities to experience here around this community.
In the same fashion, when I drive down Billtown Road and hit Seatonville Road and look over down into the valley of Floyd's Fork, I don't even think I'm in Jefferson County. That is the most grand view I can, you know, that there is in Jefferson County by far as I'm concerned.
It surprised me. You know, yes. I guess I'll be the newcomer that comes in, and you think you're going to the Midwest, and Louisville always surprises you, is the other thing I've learned. Just when you think you have it pigeonholed as southern, northern, Midwest, you know, it jumps out and bites you in a different way. That's one of the views of Big Valley, it's kind of being called, in the waterfall district, that really jumps out and gets you.
Yeah.
Our landscape, our park should reflect that. It should accent, and we want to recognize that view should look even better tomorrow than it does today by the time we're finished.
Mm-hmm. So you've talked about this Seatonville to Bardstown Road corridor maybe open to more equestrian activities. So obviously horse access, walking access, hiking, biking, walking, etc. But what about automobiles traveling the Floyd's Fork corridor?
Absolutely. We see the automobile as a natural activity within our park, as long as mm-hmm. it stays on the roads. We don't need them getting off the roads like I saw when it snowed.
Right.
So you are going to see a series of parkways intersect the park, so you'll be able to go north to south mm-hmm. Within the park and be able to get to different locations. You know, there's a lot of tension and discussion among park planners about how you deal with the automobile. But the truth is at an edge-like park, folks are going
to
use the automobile to access a lot of those facilities.
Yeah.
So if we take that on now and thoughtfully and very carefully and strategically locate that parkway so that, like Bob says, it takes advantage of hills and it takes advantage of overlooks,
mm-hmm.
and you get folks that, you know, may not have the physical ability or even the interest to go on a 20-mile mountain bike hike, but give them that park experience in a way that they can enjoy the asset just as much as folks who may be a little bit more physically enabled is something we think is vitally important.
Mm-hmm. Another great possibility for this park, and I know I sound like the Chamber of Commerce here, but I'm just so sold on this whole thing, is that there'll be some money for maintenance. It won't depend from year to year on how many tax dollars come in. You guys are well aware of the fact you have to preserve this thing forever.
Yeah, and that's, as the park manager, you know, that's as good as it gets for me, is for too long we've seen too many parks that everyone gets excited about building them, and we've all lived in communities where they built these great parks, But then, Bob, you come back 5, 10 years, and guess what was forgotten? It was the maintenance money. Yeah. It was the deferred equipment purchases, deferred repairs that really take away from the beauty of the park. I think Cherokee Park is a simply great example of that because of the work of the Olmsted Conservancy. All the noxious weeds that are being pulled out of that park now, you know, that park's coming alive. Mm-hmm. And our goal from the outset is to clearly adopt and budget for ongoing maintenance and activities in a way that doesn't burden the taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. So, Scott, what kind of employment opportunities are going to be a part of this system? You know, how do you best equip yourself to be hired on?
That's a great question. That's the million-dollar question that Dan, our CEO, always asks me, is mm-hmm. you're working on a staffing plan. And the truth is, we are. We see staffing in two directions that's probably a little different. One is, of course, our full-time staff. The philosophy we're going to bring to that is we really have a ranger commitment. Okay. You know, the greatest thing when you go into a national park is you see the guy come up in the Smokey the Bear hat.
And they know everything about the place.
And they're the coolest dudes in the world.
Exactly. Yeah.
Dudes and chicks. and so we want to have that philosophy, that approach to mm-hmm. what we do that you see in the National Park Service, the best of that.
So, a generalist to a certain degree in terms of everything that's going on.
Exactly. And we see ourselves, I think our staff will see ourselves as steward of something that's far bigger and far more important than any of us. We're stewards of a vision, and we're stewards of mm-hmm. folks who have made a heck of a commitment to this community. So we're mm-hmm. looking for that philosophical commitment. Obviously, we're going to need craftspeople, and I use the word craftsperson on purpose. Whether you're our landscape ecologist, or you're managing a foundation room, or you're cutting the grass, maintaining the horticulture and the arboriculture, there's a real craft to maintain this park because of the level of design. The second area I mentioned was, of course, the community partnerships, where we're going to be looking for partners and volunteers to join us and be part of our park opportunities. We want to provide meaningful and beneficial volunteer activities, be it if you're a volunteer park ranger and you lead nature hikes, mm-hmm. or if you've got an Eagle Scout group or a church group and you want to help us with noxious weed removal or tree plantings. We want to provide those opportunities as well, and we see those volunteers and those partners just as important to our long-term operation and sustainability as our staff.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, welcome to Louisville, and thanks for your enthusiasm, and good to have you.
Thanks. Glad to be here. And I tell you, we are so looking forward to bringing you all out on site, getting this thing rocking and rolling, and being a part of Louisville's story.
Mm-hmm. We'll do it.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
Scott Martin was named the first Parks Director of the Floyd's Fork Greenway Project this past January. For more information on the project or a link to the park's plans, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we look into what makes the onion so special. Sweet or pungent, it's one of the most widely used vegetables in the world. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
This is Bob Hill with tears in his eyes on this particular interview.
I wonder if we'll be able to learn the special tricks to avoid getting burned eyes or teary eyes when cutting onions. There's got to be.
Well, I'd let my wife prepare the food and
I
sit down and eat it.
I know.
I
love onions, though, don't you?
Yeah, I do. She sneaks it in there, uh-huh. and I'll say, boy, that was good. What was that? And she'll mention the O word, mm-hmm. and I mean,
that's the thing. It's like they go in everything.
Yeah.
They're like the ultimate flavor food.
For some reason, I have a tough time picking one up and just munching on it.
Well, I don't think you're supposed to.
A la carte, as they
mm-hmm.
say.
Right.
Or do they not say? I don't know.
I don't think really you do. Green onions are good for that.
Yeah.
Real young green
onions.
Right
out of the garden. Mm-hmm. We yank them out of the ground.
Exactly. So we'll learn all about that. Bulb onions, green onions, sweet onions, hot onions. Because joining us today to talk about probably one of the most versatile vegetables in the world, the onion, is Bill Randall. Dr. Randall is with the University of Georgia, where he teaches and does research in breeding vegetable crops for flavor, primarily concentrating on vegetables in the allium, which is the onion, and the Brassicaceae family, which is broccoli and things like that. He's also the lab leader of the Onion and Brassica Report, and we're looking forward to finding out what the research has revealed about one of the world's most popular vegetables. Bill, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Great. Before we talk about more specific onion issues, what's the history of onions in cultivation? Do you know?
The history of onions predates written record.
Yeah.
If you can go into the archaeological data, we see the evidence of onions and garlic and things like that in that family being utilized before words were ever put down on paper or stone or whatever. So they've been part of civilization for a very, very, very long mm-hmm. period of time.
As long as we've had civilization, maybe. Yeah,
probably so, probably so.
Still working on it.
So primarily used as a food, a flavor, or other ways in which to use them as well?
Many, many different ways. Okay. The obvious way and the way we use them now are to flavor foods and for their food value. Mm-hmm. But early on, they were even spiritual items.
Wow.
The center of a bulb, onion bulb that's cut in two represents affinity in the mm-hmm. spiritual context of going from something to nothing. So mm-hmm. it's held all sorts of different aspects in culture. Mm-hmm. If you go to the Egyptians, onions and garlic were used in the mummification process.
Wow. It
actually had spiritual context there. Onions were placed in the eye socket as well as in the cavity. And there's spiritual things there, but there's also the fact that onions and garlic have antimicrobial activity. And so to preserve the body or to assist in preserving the body, these vegetables were used in that way.
They chased werewolves away, too, don't they, with those things?
Vampires.
Vampires, I'm sorry.
That's right. You hang the garlic around your neck to chase vampires away.
That would attract me.
Who should do that all the time? We chase some vampires away. Bill, I'm curious about the economic value. Can you possibly put a number on the total agriculture worth of onions to the country or the world?
To the world, they are the second most important vegetable grown worldwide,
wow.
Potato being number one.
Right.
If you think about onions worldwide, there are very few cultures in the world that do not have either onions or garlic or some form of those in their diet. The ones that come to mind are Polynesia, does not utilize onions in the central part of their cuisine, and then, the Eskimos, and that's rather obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But everybody else in the world utilizes some type of onion or garlic in their diet, so it's extremely important worldwide.
So let's iron out the nomenclature of onionness. when we talk about onions, what do we talk about? You know what I mean? It's like there's bulb onions, as you said, if we need the fresh onions, like the green onions, shallots, garlic. What's an onion?
Yeah, but onions reside in a larger family, which is called Allium.
Mm-hmm.
And onions would be Allium sepa. Garlic would be Allium sativum. When you look at Allium, that bigger family, there's in the neighborhood of 700 different species. So a lot of those are weeds and don't have any agronomic value and economic value. In this country, there are probably seven Alliums that we would grow in an economic basis, including chives and leeks and elephant garlic and things like those. But onions and garlic are obviously the two mm-hmm. most important in this country.
Well, can we break down the onion thing a little further, too, in terms of bulb onions, shallots, green onions? What's
right.
the difference between those?
Shallots are a little bit of a different beast.
Okay.
They have some different flavor characteristics, and up till recently had been planted from small bulbs or bulblets,
mm-hmm.
and that's how they were propagated. As far as onions go, we have a range of different types that we would eat. The most common would be the bulb onion, where you would grow the crop and harvest a mature bulb, and that's what's consumed. Green onions, salad onions, garden onions are the immature form okay. of that.
So if I left my green onions in the ground long enough, would they actually bulb up? Not necessarily. I guess it depends on the variety.
It depends on a lot of different things,
okay.
but
we'll get into that.
Yes, if you had Allium sepa, the
okay.
the true onion or the common onion,
mm-hmm.
If you planted these and you harvested them early for the salad onions, if they were in an environment where the days got long enough to stimulate the onion to bulb, then yes, they would bulb.
Mm-hmm. So let's explore this day length issue a little bit more since you bring it up. Different parts of the country have different day lengths, the amount of hours that we have daylight, right?
Yes.
So a bulb is going to react to these day lengths.
Yes.
Can you explain that a little bit further.
To go back to the very beginning, when you're at the equator, the season never changes. You have 12 hours a day and 12 hours a night all year long.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as you go away from the equator, that seasonal difference in the amount of day versus the amount of night changes dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And the farther you get away from the equator, the more dramatic that change is. Now, the onions have been bred and selected through the years to respond to different locations and to the day length changes that actually occur. So there is a critical amount of daylight that is actually needed in order for any particular variety to grow, and we classify onions based on that requirement.
All right.
We have three basic categories. We have short day, mm-hmm. intermediate day, and long day.
So for us in Kentucky and southern Indiana, are we a short day, medium sort of day length kind of onion area?
Intermediate.
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 Okay. Okay.
Short day, usually those short day onions are grown between 35 degrees north and 35 degrees south.
Okay.
And you would be beyond that.
Okay, so we're right in the middle.
Yes.
Good for us.
Yes.
Bill, let's talk about the chemistry of the onion, that pungency you get. What creates that?
That's what makes onions and garlic unique, is those that pungent, oniony, garlicky
right.
flavors. Those are sulfur compounds. And the,
that's what can make you gassy, I guess, if you eat too many.
If you eat too much, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
There you go.
The plant takes up sulfur, and it metabolizes it to form these flavor precursor mm-hmm. compounds. If you take a dry bulb onion, an onion that you would buy in the store with intact skins, and if you smell that onion, there's very little
right.
onion flavor,
yeah.
odor that,
mm-hmm.
that you can tell. There's some, but there's very little. What's required is for the full onion flavor to develop is the cells to be damaged. And what happens is you have the sulfur flavor precursor compounds, which then are broken down by an enzyme. The enzyme is called alliinase. It's a very, very quick reaction that occurs, and what happens is that these more or less stable flavor precursor compounds get cleaved into and broken, and they form these volatile, now, flavor compounds. Mm. Some of those causes you to form tears, and that's the lacrimatory factor.
Okay.
Some of them give onions and garlic their unique flavors. Some of them give the mouth burn that we experience when onions are very, very hot.
Is that part of a natural defensive mechanism against predators?
That is the speculation. You know, obviously we can't ask insects and herbivores to
and onions.
if that's why they don't eat onions. But if you think about onions and garlic and compare them to other vegetables, they have relatively few pests
uh-huh.
that actually attack them. And the speculation and the theory is that yes, these compounds are defensive compounds.
Yeah, it makes
and
a lot of sense.
They're there to protect the plant from herbivores, things that would chew mm-hmm. on them.
Hmm. So, Bill, give us a little rundown of like the basics of onion growing and intermediate day length varieties that are good for Kentuckiana gardeners, and then you know what to do at what time to have a good onion harvest.
With an intermediate day area, as you are in Kentucky and southern Indiana, you actually have two opportunities for planting. You can either plant the onions in the fall like we do and overwinter them, you know, in a year where you get a very, very severe winter.
Right.
That's not very good. But onions are rather cold hardy
mm-hmm.
and resistant to cold damage and freezing. And in a normal year, you can plant a crop in the fall, overwinter it, and get it actually to mature late May and early June, and that would be an early harvest for an intermediate day area.
And nice sweet onions, too.
Exactly,
mm-hmm.
because you are growing
right.
them
cool.
in the coolest time of the year
gotcha.
In your particular area.
I've done that by mistake, actually. I left them in, and there they were.
The other is to plant them as early as you can work the soil
in the spring.
In the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Seed them, or you can use transplants. You could seed them in a greenhouse or in a windowsill and produce a small plant in anticipation of when you could work the soil and then plant that small plant in the field. You also have another opportunity as a home gardener is to use something called a set, which is a very small onion bulb.
That's what I like to do.
and that's actually a very good way of doing it because mm-hmm. the plant starts out very vigorously and you get a jump on the season.
Right.
You can get an earlier crop that way too.
Yeah.
How do we know when they're ready to be harvested? I think that sometimes is a point of consternation for gardeners. When are my onions ready?
Onions they give you a very visible indication on when they're ready. The foliage on top of the bulb falls over,
mm-hmm.
and we call that lodging.
Okay. Does it die back or just fall over?
They will actually fall over.
Okay.
And that falling over the leaves is an indication that the bulb is ready to harvest. And when you harvest it, then it will go into dormancy and sleep for a while.
Mm-hmm. But we have to cure them if we want to store them, right? And that's one of the tricky things, I think, in terms of, you know, that's the thing. You can't eat all your onions all at once.
Right.
So how do we most effectively get them through their storage?
Curing them. And the curing is actually just, simply put, it's the drying of the outer scales and the neck area.
Mm-hmm.
To do it simply is to, you know, tie them up and put them in a warm carport
mm-hmm.
or a garage and let them, you need good air circulation through there, mm-hmm. And let them cure that way.
Okay.
Well, Bill, Kentucky has a long and proud history of moonshine. Has anybody ever made distilled spirits or alcohol from onions?
I have to tell you a story.
Okay.
I was in Hungary. I was over there working with their dehydration onion industry in the south part of the country. And they made a drink. It was onion schnapps.
Wow.
And they'd have schnapps and they put their local onions in this thing, and they were extremely proud of it. And I hope there's no Hungarians listening. But that was the absolutely worst thing I've ever had in my life.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Hey, one last question, Bill. Are there any tricks? Actually, Bob doesn't have to worry about this because his wife does all the cooking at home. But being a cook and being someone who loves to cook with onions, certain times of the year, store-bought onions, I'm going to start doing my own now that I know how to do it in a sweeter fashion. Store-bought onions sometimes are extremely pungent and just burn the you-know-what out of your eyes when you're chopping them up. Any tricks to help sort of offset some of that?
Throw them into your refrigerator.
Okay.
And cool them down. A refrigerator is somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 degrees. And if you can get the bulbs to 40 degrees, maybe 38 degrees, the compound that causes you to tear
mm-hmm.
doesn't become a gas until about 50 degrees.
Oh.
So if you pull the onion out and begin to chop it, and as long as you do it quickly,
right,
and the onions don't warm up, the compound is actually formed, but it doesn't become a gas until it reaches about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's the quickest way to do it.
Uh-huh.
Another way, and which is more difficult, is this compound that causes you to tear, the lacrimatory factor, is very, very water soluble. So if you use a wet knife as you're cutting, as you cut, the compound goes into the water that's on the blade of the knife, and you will reduce the amount of volatility of that gas in it. It will limit it getting into your eyes.
Great.
You're the Julia Child of onions.
You are. This has been great, Bill. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Great. Thanks. Dr. Bill Randall is a vegetable crop researcher with the Department of Horticulture at the University of Georgia, where he concentrates on breeding programs for improving flavor in onions and brassica family vegetables. He spoke to us from their campus there in Athens, Georgia. If you'd like more information on his research or on onions, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few tearless listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
Okay, Bob, this was a question that I got that I have turned over to you officially because you knew
the answer.
What it was, and I had no idea.
Once a month I do one here.
It's from Shirley, and she says that she's 73 years old this month, and she has a question. Her mom, her, and her aunt had these little bushes that came up every year from seeds back in the 50s. They were a green bush. Then in the fall, they were colored, and she thinks full of seeds as well, in a, you know, a bright red. Oh. Got about 2 to 3 feet in height, some bigger, but, you know, that's on average. And her mother called them burning bushes, but she's certain they're not the burning bushes that we know of today. So she's wondering if we had any ideas about what this sort of old style coming back from seed, little flaming red bush in the fall might be.
Mom is always right. It actually is. It's an annual burning bush. And my story is, a friend of mine had these growing along his driveway in a hot, dry, just a crack in his driveway. Mm-hmm. It is an annual burning bush. The Latin on it is cochia, K-O-C-H-I-A-S-C-O-P-A-R-I-A, or cochia scuparia.
But just has the same common name, burning bush. As the...
It's the neatest plant. It's a beautiful lime to dark green. It grows 2 or 3 feet a year from one seed, turns a screaming red, orange, and purple in the fall. And then it's an annual, and then it reseeds itself in the same place.
So does it have any other common names?
No, just burning bush or annual burning bush. And actually, this I sent off for 200 seeds as soon as I read this.
Did you really?
Because I want it back.
Okay.
It's just a very distinctive plant.
It's not like an invasive or anything.
No, well,
is it?
I researched that all I could, and apparently not.
Okay.
Because mine died off after 2 or 3 years. I had it before, and as did my neighbors.
Okay.
So that's what it is, Shirley. Mom is right.
All right. So what's the Latin word again?
It's K-O-C-H-I-A. Just Google that up,
and
you'll see it. Burning bush, K-O-C-H-I-A.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you very much.
You betcha.
Mystery solved.
Yeah.
All right. A couple more questions, Bob. This one's from Karen. I feel so sorry for my hellebores. They've begun to put up leafy stalks with flowers on them, but the large winter damaged leaves overshadow the flowers and the new growth. Should I be cutting these damaged leaves off and their stalks, or is it too early?
Well, I have the same problem when I cut the damaged leaves off and left the light green on.
That's right. Now's the time to do it,
And I really had a bad winter for them, too. I was amazed how bad they looked in the pots, anyway. But they're just cut off the dead stuff, and they'll be up.
Yeah. And honestly, as soon as the new stuff emerges, that's your cue, you know, to get rid of the rest of the stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
That's part of the game with the hellebores.
Yep.
One for you, Miss Wishy, from Nelda. Is there any product to put on my lawn to control weeds that doesn't include fertilizer? I have to mow often enough as it is.
I hear you, Nelda.
Yeah.
That's my philosophy, too. And, of course, you know, we do continue to remind people that the best time to fertilize your lawn is in the fall of the year if you do it at all. But you can buy just pre-emergence. So look for, you know, corn gluten, actually. Go to your local hardware store or garden center, and you can buy simply pre-emergent weed control that's in granular formulation. And there are some organic, you know, alternatives, including corn gluten, if you'd like to go that route. And the pre-emergent will prevent the weed seed, the annual weed seed, from germinating.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just look for it. But there are products, although most of them try to sell you the fertilizer, too. But don't buy into it.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. It's a waste of money.
If you have a burning question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, your Latin word of the week sort of reminded me of a song from Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Oh, yeah, and what's that?
I don't know which one it is, but this is the kind of word they would use in one of their songs.
All right, the Latin.
Any of the Creedence songs.
That's true.
Yeah.
Especially back in the 70s, right?
Yeah, right.
Euliginosa.
See, I could hear him singing that.
Isn't that a great word, euliginosa?
Yeah, it means sort of all wet.
It's all wet. It's in honor of Floyd's fork.
That's all.
Oh. Euliginosa of marshes, swamps, and wet places.
I'm going to my room. I feel chastised.
All right. For example, Betula euliginosa.
The birch.
Which is a birch.
Loves
a type
wet.
Of birch
yeah.
that, of course, does like, to, in fact, to grow around, you know, water.
Yeah.
Salvia euliginosa.
The swamp salvia.
A salvia that can live in that swampy, wet place. See, these are good words to know because if you have an area that's wet in your garden or in your backyard or wherever that stays consistently wet, these are the types of plants that are going to do well. Anything that says euliginosa. Dryopteris euliginosa.
The wood fern. We just talked about that, I think. Is one of the specialties from last week.
This is a variety across that actually will do well in a very wet place. Solidago euliginosa.
The bog goldenrod.
Felicia euliginosa.
Oh, the March blue marguerite.
Marguerite, a little daisy-like
thing.
Oh,
yeah, sure.
Valeriana euliginosa.
Or the mountain valerian.
Mountain valerian. Calm you down a little bit, too, maybe.
Yeah.
Mesia euliginosa.
The Mesia moss.
Mesia moss. There's got to be a moss that likes a wet area.
That's also a CCR song. They know somebody named Mesia moss.
I can relate to that, sure. That makes more sense. Yeah. All right, so euliginosa of marshes, swamps, and wet places. Definitely a good indicator in terms of a plant thriving if you've got a wet place in your backyard. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you'll join us again next week for a new show.
Homegrown is produced by that dry wit genius, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.